This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, I'm Sharad Kutan with Ibrahim Sunny, and it's 35 minutes past 9. Just a quick note, we put out a Twitter poll this morning on DBKL's plan to limit parking in the Central Business District by 2 hours as a way of controlling traffic congestion there. So far, we've had 125 votes. It's it is effective, will be effective. It says 20% of the votes that's come in, and no, say 80% of those, because there's we try to put out a poll several times a week. It's kind of like a BFM referendum.
In fact, I think that's what
referendums.
Yeah, referendum. This we're going to start calling it that going forward.
Okay, it's now time for Pressing Matters on the Morning Round, the show that takes you beyond the headlines of the day. And joining us on the show today is P. Gunasegaram. He's a former editor of Kini Biz and an independent writer and consultant. Two big stories that we have, the question of Chief Minister Penang Lim Guan Eng, should he resign now that he's been charged, or should he not? And also the question of the Brexit and its impact on the economy, both in Britain and worldwide, including Malaysia. Now, let's start with the question of Lim Guan Eng. You've actually written a column on this, haven't you, Gunnar?
Yeah, this was before he was charged, actually, at the time that the issue was coming up. So I think the question is, no one is refuting one point here, that he bought the bungalow land at below market price. So that is something that everyone seems to be agreed on, this bungalow at 25 Jalan Pinhon in Green Lane. So that was bought for 2.8 million, or about 276 per square foot. The previous owner, Pang Lee Kun, bought it at 2.5 million, or $246 per square foot, in September 2008. And it was rented to Lim for 6 years at 5,000 a month, and Lim Guan Eng had agreed that he knew that the stamp duty valuation for the house was 4.2 million. You know, so the even if we use this this value, Lim underpaid by 1.47 million, which is a significant sum. And if we use the 7.3 million valuation, which using new LH values of land which have been transacted at the same price, then you have an underpayment which is 4.5 million. So the question is, I mean, is it okay for a public official to take gratification, even if it is not tied to a particular event? So
it's okay. Yeah. So let's maybe it's for some sort of conceptual clarity. Gratification would be accepting a gift in exchange for something. Have we established in this case, if there was something that was exchanged in return for this undervalued sale?
Yeah. So I think I'm not sure about the legal provision. In fact, you know, since he has already been charged, we can't really discuss too much of it. But in this case here, the leaving aside legalities, is it okay for a chief minister to take a donation, a gratification from a member of the public, you know? Is that all right? You know, or would he be compromising his position if he did something like that? Is the question.
Yeah, Ibrahim. I mean, you know, this. You know, politicians, especially those from the federal opposition. He's in the government in Penang. But the federal opposition is part of the member of the federal opposition. Especially when you think of the narrative of political persecution, do you think, and why do you think, he opened himself to this possibility of being charged on something which, even in an ordinary sense, might open you up to the whiff of impropriety, right? Even in a functioning democracy, you think, why would a politician, you know, expose himself in this way?
Because, okay, so that's absolutely a fair question to ask. More so, so I'm adding on to that question before I start answering it, is that politicians, particularly members from DAP in particular, they like to make a strong position on transparency governance. They are against corruption. They want politicians to be not just against corruption, but also to be seen to be against corruption. So this is the fool questioning. And the question is, the answer to this is, wouldn't it be better for the DAP to take a position to say, you know what, we're going to take a step back and say that Lim Wan Eng should take a leave of absence and lead the case of defense for himself in full force, and deputize the role of governorship or the roles of a chief minister to those that are more able and not encumbered by this legal case.
Okay, but coming back, Gunnar, I mean, the question is, was there impropriety in this transaction?
All right. Well, you see, impropriety does not take place just in the form of cash. I think to most people's mind, well, if this person had given 1.47 million in cash instead of an undervaluation of the property, to most people's mind, that would be unacceptable. So what difference does it make if you give it through an inflated asset valuation or an underinflated asset valuation? What difference does it make? But because you can actually realize the amount by selling the property if you need to. Or it is a value which accrues to you anyway. So it's a value in kind. In this case, it is not money, but it can be easily converted to money.
Now, what Gunnar is trying to establish is the principle of this, which I fully agree with. But there's also the story of what the UMNO guys are trying to do, or Barisan, or even Utusan. They're trying to show a link between the gratification and the fact that there was a change of classification of property in Taman Manggis. And the link that those guys are trying to make is that the timeline fits, particularly when the City Council, the Majlis Pembandaran, has said no to the change of the gazettement of the residential property in Taman Manggis. But then the Chief Minister took a unilateral decision to nullify that verdict and approve of that switch.
But the important link here is Ms. Pang, right? So Ms. Pang would have had to have some material, must gain materially from that change in status, right? So that is what is important in this narrative of the gratification and the payoff.
To which the Utusan folks have said that Ms. Pang did receive that gratification from that Taman Manggis sale. So I don't know whether that link is tenuous to be made, but the problem here is that it's two cases to be discussed in one, not just the house itself.
That too. But at the same time, I mean, these are the matters which will be actually part of the court case now, so to speak. But I mean, on the other side, I think we have to agree that this is also selective prosecution. There have been, the case of one MDB is the one that stares in our face. So much of money has gone, 14 billion is missing, according to one MDB's own admission. But there has been not even a single police report made over this, by the 1MDB officials, let alone any kind of prosecution. 2.6 billion, now the figure has become 4.2 billion in donations have been made, and there has been no prosecution or major investigation as well. So I mean, those are relevant questions. But at the same time, that, in my view, Lim Guan Eng's behavior, as far as the land was concerned, was inappropriate as well.
Yes. Yeah. So on the story of this 1MDB, right, and that selective prosecution narrative that is being carried forward, at least by the folks of Penang right now, don't you think that the story of 1MDB being heard at the PAC with changes, material changes happening at the board of directors and board of advisors, don't you think that's enough in terms of managing that perception on 1MDB?
Not at all, because here, for instance, is it okay for a leader of a country to have 4.2 billion ringgit, donated into his account directly, So, even if it was made by the Saudi royal family, for instance, that raises all kinds of questions, And then the other thing is, at 1MDB's own admission, 14 billion ringgit has gone missing, which they made a payment to a company. That company is now non-existent. It's already been wound up. So surely there must have been some kind of a wrongdoing for something like this to happen. Where is the investigation? Where is the police report?
Okay.
Where is
the... Very quickly, gentlemen, I mean, do you think Guan Eng should step aside and resign? Ibrahim? Yes or no?
I think yes. I think yes. At least not step aside as in resign, but maybe step aside quite literally. Just take a step back and say, I will take a leave of absence and sort out everything out.
Okay.
I think he should take a leave of absence. You know, if he's found not guilty, he's going to be removed as chief minister anyway.
All right.
If he's not found guilty, he comes back as chief minister.
Okay, if you
Hang on. Sharad, what do you think?
I think there are two considerations. One is the functioning of the entire system. So applying these principles are very important. And I think you want to hold on to these principles, right? But the question is, if you don't believe in the integrity of the institutions involved, in the judiciary, in the Attorney General's office, in the MACC, then why should you play the game? Otherwise, you know, because then what it becomes for people involved.
My answer to that, my answer to that will be that impropriety already happened when he accepted, the sale of the house at an undervalued value. You know,
absolutely
undervalued price. So that is the point. You know, whether he is found guilty by the courts or not. There has been this which has happened.
Yeah. And also, whether or not, irrespective of whether you trust the organizations, you trust the establishment, the system, it is irrelevant considering the fact that he accepted the transfer in the first place.
Okay, so the question of whether there's going to be a Lim Guan exit or not hangs in the air.
Okay.
We left you with the cliffhanger. The Guangzit, as I like to call it, question. But we're going to wait for this story to unfold. And of course, it's a very serious one. And I think a lot of Malaysians are concerned about the future of democracy in this country.
It's worth noting that because he's formally charged now, much of the case can't be discussed, at least in a public forum, because of the events that will be transpired at the courts. So the rest of what we're doing right now would be conjecture, I suppose.
Yeah. We come back to the other global story, which is the Brexit, the vote that is going to shape Britain's future for some time to come. Though there are many questions around it.
Yeah.
The government of Britain has not invoked the Article 50 to set in motion the actual exit. Never mind the question of the processes involved. I mean, Gunnar, what do you think about that? The fact that they haven't, set in motion the exit plan?
I think also, one has to look at it here in the context of it being essentially a British problem. First, it's tearing Britain apart. You know, for one, the vote was 51.9 exit, 48.1% to leave. But look at Scotland, 62% to 32% stay. You know, Northern Ireland, 45% to 44.2%. Stay. London, 60 to 40 stay. So it's basically there are deep divisions within the United Kingdom is not so united at this point of time over this. So Scotland is pressing for another referendum to see whether they want to stay in Britain or not. You know, because when they voted to stay in Britain in 2014, Britain was not expected to leave the EU at that point of time. So now, so there is going to be a lot of uncertainty, I believe, as far as Britain itself is concerned. If Britain wants to leave, they have got about 2 years to do that. You know, so you have a 2 year period where a lot of things will be happening, and then what happens after the 2 years? So you might have certain uncertainty for about 2 to 3 years in the UK.
Do you think, I mean, it's been a week or so since the referendum vote, right? We've always known that the referendum is not legally binding. David Cameron doesn't have to set things in motion. Britain doesn't have to leave. If the British political establishment, it might be committing political suicide, but it really can say, well, okay, you voted, but we're not going to set this in motion. If you want this, perhaps we have to go back to the electorate, have a general election, and then let your government, stake
its majority of people think that I think UK will leave because of the, that's the nature of their politics. So David Cameron has resigned because he felt that, Britain should stay in. So
I think that's also the story of the Conservative leadership. Everybody thought and expected even that the lead campaigner for the Leave camp, Boris Johnson, would fight to become the Prime Minister. And more importantly, to execute the Brexit. But because he's not running for the premiership, the question now falls on other candidates within the Tory leadership, including Theresa May, including Michael Gove. Now, whether or not they will execute that or implement the Brexit, that is the bigger cause than of concern right now.
I think the nature of the uncertainty, you know, is also is very evident from the fact that Britain still does not have a new leader to replace David Cameron. So that that leadership issue itself is one. You know? So it looks like Britain might be in a limbo for a little while. Perhaps it may, you know, the amount of uncertainty may reduce after the first few months, you know.
Gunnar, when you look at this, right, is this a story where politics is, you know, and the individual ambitions of politicians, in this case Boris Johnson, right? So there's one theory that the whole Leave campaign was really a gambit for him, for leadership of the Conservative Party. It really wasn't about him truly believing that Britain needed to leave the EU. That this was really just... And do you think, I mean, do you think there's some truth in it? That this is really about politics kind of skewing the story?
Pretty difficult to say, but I think Boris Johnson has sort of withdrawn himself from the race, you know, for leadership.
Yeah, because he was stabbed in the back by, you know, the members of the other members of the Leave campaign who, you know, suddenly came out and said, well, he's, you know, a divisive figure and he's not worthy of, you know, he's not going to be able to unite the party. And it's become a party issue.
But if we move, say, from the political to the economic area where it's a little bit more easy, it's easier to sort of like gauge the impact. Let's see. I mean, what would this do in terms of the international economy? You know, so Britain is no longer a very huge player in the international economy. In terms of trade with Malaysia, it's really not very much as well. So the international impact may be muted. You know, what might happen is some other countries might want to leave EU. So you may have a situation where there may be pressure on the. There might be a pressure for the breakup of EU itself. If some of the big ones like, France or Germany should want to leave the EU. So that might be actually causing some uncertainty for the existence, very existence of the EU itself. And so you might have countries turning inwards. You know? So if they do that, then that is generally considered bad for trade as well as the overall economy. And under these kind of situations, people who go to safe haven currencies like your US dollar, your Swiss franc, you know, the Japanese yen at this point in time.
Yeah.
Well, okay, come back to the kind of political moment in this, Gunnar. And Ibrahim also, you know, do you think an issue of such complexity should have been put to a simple vote of leave or remain? I mean, should...
They did that. It was a
but
yes.
But should it? Should it? That's my question.
I think if I recall correctly, I think that was a promise that David Cameron made to the electorate that he will have a referendum on the EU if he was returned to power.
But is it a responsible kind of promise for... I mean,
personally, I don't think so. You know, because I think it's very difficult to decide things on referendum. Okay, you have decided to join EU, you know, so... It should be sort of like better for better or for worse, unless something really bad happens. Because I mean, otherwise it is so wrenching for the entire economy, and it's so needless at the end of the day.
Somebody once said that David Cameron made that claim or promise to have that referendum during that. General election period. Now, if you remember, Sharad, this morning we spoke about a World Economic Forum article saying that our minds are wired to fear only the short-term threats. Now, what was David Cameron's short-term threat during the election? It was to win the election outright. And he makes, not just him actually, politicians around the world, both democratically and pseudo-democratically elected, they tend to make these claims, and many of them have to follow through on these promises. And one of the promises, many of the promises can be as silly as, you know, asking to leave the United Kingdom, the EU. And because of that, this is considered being dubbed as, at least the major papers in the UK, as the biggest political sabotage, self-sabotage that has ever happened. And you're right, it shouldn't be made as such.
You know, Gunnar, you've been around a long time. The rest of us,
and still
of us
look
in the
very
room.
Ravishing. And yeah.
No, Margaret Thatcher. Margaret Thatcher was, as it were, conjured up from the grave to defend varying positions, both Leave and Remain within the Conservative Party, right? And Margaret Thatcher was always very resistant to forms of integration with Europe, right? And yet at every point she followed through with integration, right? How do you think, when you look at Margaret Thatcher and her legacy as a conservative leader, somebody who believed in free trade, somebody who, you know, in some ways defines the right in terms of economic policy, yet was for economic integration?
I think rightly or wrongly, the UK felt that a lot of EU policies were being made without reference to UK itself, and which didn't make sense to UK. No, so even when you talk about Thatcher, although the UK was part of EU, it had its own currency, you know. So they did actually try to keep certain amount of independence from the EU itself.
I mean, they got a lot of privileges,
yes.
Right? I mean, they were exceptions were made for Britain that were not made for other members of the EU.
That's right. So, I mean, in a way, while they were in EU, they were a country apart from EU. They were not part of, like, continental Europe, you know? So, which is why I suppose maybe the EU wants them to go as soon as possible, which would also reduce the uncertainty for the European Union as well.
What do you think of Margaret Thatcher's legacy in this discussion about the EU?
I think she's the stalwart of the Conservative Party, and I think this will be the end of the Tory as we know it. I think Labour will rise in power. I think UKIP will now gain more, you know, popularity. Even the Scottish National Party will gain more ground. So that's the end of the Conservatives.
Well, that's Ibrahim Sani looking into his crystal ball, which he brings into the studio every morning. Thank you so much, Gunnar. That was
Welcome.
P. Gunasegaram, former editor of Kini Biz, an independent writer and consultant. That's all we have on The Morning Run today. I'm Sharad Kutan with Ibrahim Sani, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.